These voices made headlines this week.
So we must make it clear that our goal is freedom.
As the venerable Arabic saying has it, our house is your house.
Jeremy has been upset over the disloyalty which Mr. O'Hare has demonstrated towards me and my family.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines, the sounds of the news this week, gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
This is Fred Foy with Voices in the Headlines.
I'd like for you to know that I'm proud of the people of Mississippi. I'm proud of their forbearance and their restraint, and the fact that thus far they have to a great extent ignored these people who call themselves leaders and who have put on this so-called march.
The governor of the state of Mississippi, Paul Johnson, talking to the people of Mississippi on Friday, after a week of turmoil and violence, at the end of almost a month of intense civil rights activity in Mississippi. It had begun 3 weeks ago in a small way. A single Negro, James Meredith, had set off on a march to the capital of Mississippi to show that he, one Negro, was not afraid. But fear, violence, and hatred also walked the roads of Mississippi. James Meredith was cut down by a sniper, wounding Meredith with a shotgun. Then angry civil rights workers vowed to finish Meredith's march. Throughout the month, the march went on, edging closer, ever closer to the heart of Mississippi, closer to places already infamous in their association with civil rights troubles and deaths, closer to a place called Philadelphia, Mississippi. Tuesday, June 21st, again violence, as whites stoned the marchers led by Martin Luther King. One of those roughed up in the battle was ABC News cameraman George Romilly.
One of the young hecklers from Philadelphia came up behind me, grabbing a hold of my camera, and in a jujitsu type fashion threw me over his shoulder and smashing me and my camera to the ground, while the police in the town just sort of stood around and watched this whole scene and let him run on off away.
The violence at Philadelphia on Tuesday, Dr. King said, was the fault of the police. Dr. King's charges were answered by Philadelphia, Mississippi Police Chief Bruce Latimer.
I'd say we got good policemen, and they did a good day's work. I would say that there wasn't sufficient protection, and I'd say it would take 400 policemen to give them the protection. We had two mobs at Met here in Philadelphia, and anything can happen.
The Philadelphia violence prompted march leaders to decide to march back to Philadelphia under the leadership of Dr. King.
And so we must make it clear that our goal is freedom, and that we aren't going to stop until we reach that goal, and we must go out here singing and believing and with the eternal faith that we are on the march and we ain't going to let nobody turn us around.
But there were other Mississippi names to be written in violence this week. Canton, Mississippi, where marchers set up a tent against the orders of the police. ABC's Don Farmer was there.
There goes a tear gas bomb. There goes another one. Three, four. And he goes dropping to the ground as the canisters move in. Tear gas has flooded this area now. Many of the Negroes have dropped to the ground. The wind is blowing the tear gas directly into the tent, extremely effective. The tear gas is now pouring across the church site. Here come some newsmen, their eyes streaming with tear gas. Here come the troopers now, moving toward me. Many of these people overcome by the tear gas smoke, their eyes pouring, coughing and choking. Some women crying. Troopers now moving back toward the tent, wearing their gas masks.
After the marchers had been dispersed by the tear gas, Canton, Mississippi City Attorney Bob Goza told ABC,
a certain amount of tear gas was used after the group continued to refuse the order to disperse. The only alternative was to either use a sufficient amount of tear gas, a modest amount, I shall say, or to physically remove them.
And the Reverend Martin Luther King had words about the Mississippi towns of Canton and Philadelphia.
Both of these communities are very tough communities. They're very tough counties. And we are fully aware of the dangers involved. We are fully aware of the terror and the violence and brutality existing in the communities. But the civil rights movement doesn't stop because of these threats and because of this kind of harassment.
It was a week of increased tension with the eyes of the nation and the world on Mississippi. The march that had started out as one man's demonstration that he was not afraid had become stained with deeper hatreds, marred by violence, clouded with tear gas. As the week came to an end, the marchers neared their destination of Jackson. Despite disagreements between march leaders, James Meredith rejoined the march, and he and other civil rights leaders were still hopeful in spite of this week's troubles. Charles Evers of the NAACP said,
"We hope to suggest to the marchers when they get to Jackson on Sunday that we don't stop now. Maybe we take a break until around the 15th of July, and then we take a swing back up 61, as I said before, and go into the thickly populated area of Negroes, from Vicksburg into the Tennessee line, and register all the Negroes as possible there."
And James Meredith was looking even farther into the future.
In another 20 years, Mississippi is going to be the Negro showplace of this country. I really believe that. I believe that because the problem is most pressing there. And that's where the answer is going to have to come in order for existence to go on. And I wouldn't be surprised if Mississippi didn't set the pattern for this country and race relations.
The Meredith March, after all its violence and diversions and detours, was to end Sunday in Jackson after a wind-up rally on Saturday in Tougaloo, where Martin Luther King said,
"We are still in a great dilemma. We still have a long, long way to go in the civil rights struggle. The Mississippi March highlights that. The only thing that I can say to the nation is that every person of goodwill should rededicate himself or herself to the task of making justice a reality for all people in this nation."
And while that march through Mississippi was coming down the home stretch, there were racial troubles in other parts of the country. On Tuesday night, police and Negro youths battled at Pompano Beach, Florida, after a white store owner allegedly slapped a Negro boy. And Thursday night, racial clashes in Cleveland, Ohio. Police Sergeant Jack Latko said,
"We had all group of roving people. Apparently there was a little rock throwing. There was a little bit of damage to property."
And in the middle of this troubled week in American race relations, there was a speech in Louisville, Kentucky, by the director of the War Against Poverty, Sergeant Shriver.
"Now, the advocates of violence cry out and they say, we can wait no longer. We want freedom now. But for those of us who are champions of personal responsibility, nonviolent methods, our cry must be bigger than freedom now. It must be education now, food now, health now, jobs now, justice now, as well as freedom now."
A week of trouble between the races in America. In Vietnam's Central Highlands, big new battles between Americans and large enemy units from North Vietnam. The toll of communist dead was heavy, leading one American commander to say, "This is no bargain basement operation." That operation was dubbed Operation Nathan Hale, and while it was on, ABC's Roger Peterson talked with Sergeant James Ewing of Pottstown, Pennsylvania.
"How bad was this compared to other things you've been in?"
This was, I'd say, about... wasn't the worst one we've been in, but been a pretty bad one.
Yeah, well, you guys handled yourself pretty well, according to the bodies you got laying around here."
"Yeah, got quite a few."
"Well, they hit you with quite a bit, didn't they?"
"Yes, they did. They had mortars, these bazooka rounds, All kinds of things. I just can't name every damn thing they had.
While Americans were battling the invading communists in South Vietnam, United Nations Secretary General U Thant was talking in New York.
The war in Vietnam is one of the most barbarous wars in history. I think the sooner the parties involved sit down at the conference table after these conditions have been met, the better will be not only for Vietnam, but for the rest of the world.
French President Charles de Gaulle started his much-heralded visit to Russia this week. ABC's George Watson described the scene in Moscow.
And now an enormous black Chaika, the Russian equivalent of a Cadillac, is driving up in front of the Moscow City Hall here on Gorky Street, which is sort of the Fifth Avenue of Moscow, preceded by a motorcycle escort, photographers, and now the black limousine carrying French President Charles de Gaulle. Now the Russians have suddenly decided to let thousands of people into the area in front of the city hall here, and there is a really a mad crush of people. This is a more unruly crowd than I have ever seen in Moscow. They're pressing against us, and it's getting rather tight. The police do not seem to be too disturbed as yet, but there is quite a bit of pushing and shoving up to the door of the Mossoviet.
De Gaulle was given a look at Russia's space center in Siberia, the first time a Westerner has had that opportunity. But there were no apparent dramatic developments in French-Soviet relations during the de Gaulle visit, and at least one American official didn't expect any. Presidential advisor McGeorge Bundy said,
"The recognition of China was a gesture with no practical result, and the present specter of a deal with Moscow is sheer fantasy, as far beyond French power as it is contrary to French intentions."
There was another famous visitor in the news this week, the King of Saudi Arabia. King Faisal of Saudi Arabia speaking on the South Lawn of the White House, an official guest of the President of the United States.
"We look forward to very fruitful exchanges of views these next few days. As the venerable Arabic saying has it, our house is your house. Once again, I extend to you on behalf of all the American people a hearty welcome to our land."
But one part of America's house, New York City, turned out to be a place of less than goodwill for King Faisal and an embarrassment to the president and the country. On Wednesday, King Faisal, who spoke through interpreters, was quoted as saying that anyone who helped the country of Israel was an enemy of Saudi Arabia. About one-third of New York's population is Jewish, and some were angry at that quoted remark by the king. Mayor John Lindsay commented,
"The remark is extremely offensive, not just to Jews, but to all citizens of New York. I personally was very deeply disturbed. But more importantly, I, as mayor, have an obligation to prevent, wherever possible, abrasive divisions within our city."
Because of that, Mayor Lindsay made a decision.
"This city normally extends its welcome to all who visit. We put aside personal disagreements and views in so doing. In this instance, however, in view of the remarks made in Washington yesterday, we have had no other choice than to cancel the city's official reception planned for this evening."
Mayor Lindsay wasn't alone in snubbing King Faisal. A spokesman for New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller said,
"While the governor feels that all Americans should treat their foreign visitors with traditional courtesy, our visitors should be willing to treat all citizens of this country, which has been dedicated since its beginnings to the ideals of religious tolerance and the brotherhood of man, with equal courtesy."
But King Faisal went to New York anyway and was given an official welcome to the United Nations, including a luncheon which United States Ambassador Arthur Goldberg, a Jew, attended. A spokesman for Goldberg said,
"He takes a view, as far as this lunch is concerned, that the Secretary General has invited him to lunch, and he always tries to accept an invitation from the Secretary General of the United Nations."
New York City, said to be the most sophisticated city in the world, while officially ignoring King Faisal on his official visit to the United States, was the host this week for an unusual collection of people. Those are the voices of pickets. Not unusual for New York, where someone is almost always picketing someone or something. But these were members of a group called Young Americans for Freedom, and they were picketing communists, meeting in a public convention for the first time in 7 years. The communists heard their leader, Gus Hall.
There is one matter that casts its ugly shadow over our lives, over everything we do. This is the criminal, brutal U.S. imperialist aggression against the people of Vietnam. This is the most vicious, savage, uncivilized assault on a small nation in the annals of human history.
Outside, ABC's Mort Krim had a question for the anti-communist pickets.
Do you think the communists should have a right to have a convention in this country?
No, no, not at all.
We think they should have a right to go back to Russia, though.
I believe that this was is an extraordinary case. Extraordinary because the depth of the corruption, the variety of it, the scope of it, and the subtlety of it, plus the fact that the perpetrator of it was a United States senator in a very powerful position, meant that the normal law enforcement procedure could not apply.
That was the voice of James Boyd, a former assistant to Senator Thomas Dodd, Democrat of Connecticut. Boyd was opening witness in a Senate ethics investigation of alleged misconduct by Senator Dodd. ABC's Wally Bruner had a question for Boyd.
Mr. Boyd, you triggered something that has turned out to be pretty big. Do you have any second thoughts about it?
I think it was worthwhile. I think that I hope that the results of it will be lasting, and that it will be one of the causes of a reform of ethical procedures. And I think that, therefore, any personal inconvenience that it might have caused me are more than rewarded, and I have no regrets, and if I had it to do again, I would act as I have acted.
Along with Boyd, another former aide to Senator Dodd gave testimony alleging that Senator Dodd was guilty of official misconduct in his relationship with Chicago public relations man Julius Klein. Mrs. Marjorie Carpenter was one of the Dodd aides who took documents from Senator Dodd's office and gave them to newspaper columnists Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson. Correspondent Wally Bruner interviewed Mrs. Carpenter about that.
Mrs. Carpenter, could you tell us just exactly why you took the documents from Senator Dodd's office and why you are testifying here today?
We felt that it was the only way to report what we considered was grave misconduct, and we're sorry that it had to be done that way. But I think what has happened since then has shown us that it would have been entirely futile to do it any other way.
As the Dodd hearings went on, Senator Dodd charged that Mrs. Carpenter had lied about a conversation between two Dodd aides, a conversation in which the two men allegedly talked about Dodd taking money from Julius Klein. On the matter of the Carpenter testimony, Senator Dodd was asked if he plans to bring perjury charges against Mrs. Carpenter.
Yes, I do. I intend to ask the Attorney General to bring charges of perjury. I believe that under the law, two witnesses who deny the charge found a case of perjury. And both of them are here, Mr. Martin and Mr. Zyla, whom this woman named. And I'd like them to say what the facts are and how untrue that statement is.
This would be perjury. You would ask the Justice Department to file perjury charges against Mrs. Carpenter?
I certainly will.
At one point in the Dodd hearings, another witness against Dodd, Michael O'Hare, said he'd been threatened by Senator Dodd's son, Jeremy. A spokeswoman for Senator Dodd read a statement in which Senator Dodd apologized for his son and then added,
"This morning, while my son, Jeremy, was having breakfast in one of the Senate cafeterias, he unexpectedly met Michael O'Hare. Mr. O'Hare had worked in my office for over 4 years and was very close to my entire family. My son, Jeremy, has been upset over the disloyalty which Mr. O'Hare has demonstrated towards me and my family.
The investigation into the affairs of Senator Thomas Dodd continues next week in Washington.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret.
In Washington this week, President Johnson gave a medal to a soldier just back from Vietnam. Lieutenant Charles Williams of the Green Berets listened as the president spoke.
Lieutenant Williams, it is hard for your president to find words to tell you of the great and deep gratitude and admiration that your fellow Americans have for you. But I do rejoice that I may present to you, in the name of the Congress of the United States and of the grateful people of America, the Medal of Honor.
And then Lieutenant Charles Williams, his Medal of Honor hanging from its sky blue ribbon, spoke to the president.
This is the greatest thing that has ever happened to me or ever will happen. I only hope and pray that I'm deserving of this high award. As President Eisenhower once said, with all due respect to you, sir, and your duties, he would rather have the Medal of Honor than be President of the United States. And these are my sentiments. This medal will always be as much a part of you as it is of me. For our deceased comrades who aren't with us today from Dong Xuai, I may offer some small condolence to loved ones. These brave and courageous men did not die in vain, but for a true and just cause which makes our great country what it is today.
Make him one of America's best. He'll be a man they'll test one day. Have him win the Green Beret.
So went This World This Week and the voices in the headlines.
Voices in the Headlines, a presentation of ABC Radio News. Written and produced by H. Paul Jeffers. Directed by Bill Gately. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Audio engineering by Gene Carlson, Bob Walter, and John Madeline. Your narrator, Fred Foy. This is Ed Jordan inviting you to keep up with the news every hour of every day on this ABC Radio News station and to catch up with the news each week on Voices in the Headlines.